Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure to check out all the other things that 1517 does. The academy courses, the articles, the conferences, all that kind of stuff. We have two events coming up in 2022. And so you want to check out both of those. We have a regional event in Northwest Arkansas in April. You want to check that out. And we have a national event in San Diego, which is in October. So you want to come to one or both of those. You can get all the information over at 1517.org. Chad, we are going to build us a temple in this week's episode. Solomon has cut a deal with the king of Tyre. He's got the cedars floating down the river. He's got the oil floating the other direction. And the deal has been cut, and we're going to see if we can construct a house for the Lord.
Yeah, we're going to do a little architecture in this podcast. Actually, more theology than architecture, but we got to deal with some architectural features as well. I don't know when we covered the tabernacle. Do you remember when that was? I know it was back in Exodus, but
long time ago. That was
3-4 years ago. It's been a while. So I'm sure your memories are a little bit rusty about some of the details with the tabernacle and some other stuff in Leviticus. So we'll be stepping back there on occasion, talking about the temple in this chapter as well as the next chapter. There's so much here. I was preparing this morning just thinking, man, we could spend a lot of time on a lot of the details. So we'll have to, you know, skim some of this. But we do want to hit the highlights and, you know, kind of get in our minds a picture of what the temple was like, what it looked like, and its basic structure and some of the furnishings that are there. And along the way, we want to kind of dig into the temple theology and how it stretches backward to creation, and then how it stretches forward to Christ and the church. Because there's a sense in which the temple is sort of this hinge structure, if you will, between what came before and then what is coming after. So anyway, some good stuff to get to. We're in 1 Kings 6, verse 2. We're told that the house that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long and 20 cubits wide and 30 cubits high. So the typical explanation of a cubit is that it's about a foot and a half long. So we're looking at a structure that, you know, is, when you compare it to modern worship facilities, it's really not that big. So it's in feet, and apologies to our European listeners who don't work with feet, but we're Americans, so we just do feet.
That's right.
It's 90 feet long and 30 feet wide and 45 feet high. That's, you know, when you kind of compare that to a house or a church or something like that. If this was a church and you drove by it, you'd say to yourself, man, that's a tiny church. Because it really is. It's not that big. But yeah,
dimensions of it. It's like 2,700 square feet.
Man, I don't do math.
Something like that. 30 by 90?
Yeah. So yeah, that would be right.
It's also like long and skinny, man. Like this is like the long fellowship hall.
It is, yeah. It's long and skinny, and so that is the core structure. And as we'll see in just a minute, there's more to it. There's going to be an entryway, a vestibule, as it's sometimes translated, and there's also things along the side. So we'll get to those in just a minute, but kind of get that in your mind right now. We're talking about the temple proper is 90 by 30 by 45. And that is, by the way, we don't know how high the tabernacle was. It's a tent after all. So that really wasn't an issue. But this is twice the dimensions of the tabernacle. So when you go from tabernacle to temple, you're doubling in size, which also emphasizes the point that the tabernacle was tiny. I mean, it wasn't a pup tent, of course, but it wasn't like some monstrosity circus tent. It was pretty tiny.
Well, things were harder to build back then.
Yeah, especially when you consider, as we'll see in a minute, they were cutting all the stuff elsewhere and hauling it in. I mean, this was a huge undertaking. So anyway, that's where we're starting out. We're just kind of getting the dimensions in our mind. And then we're told that the vestibule, that's what I referred to a minute ago, the vestibule in front of the nave of the house was 20 cubits long, equal to the width of the house, and 10 cubits deep in front of the house. So we've really got, you kind of got three different parts to to the temple. You've got this vestibule or entryway, which in Hebrew is the ulam. And then you've got kind of the main structure, which is the holy place. So, you know, you got the most holy place, and then you got the holy place. The holy place is the hekal in Hebrew, which is translated here as nave, which is a church word, by the way. And then you got the inner sanctum, which is the holy of holies, which in Hebrew is the devir. So the ulam, the hekal, and the devir, the vestibule or entryway, the main part of the temple, the holy place, the nave, and then you've got the holy of holies. So if you're a church person, church architecture person, it'd be kind of equivalent to the church's narthex, where you walk in, and then to the nave, which is the main worship place, and then the chancel, which is where things like the pulpit or the altar would be. So that's something new. I mean, we don't have anything like this in the tabernacle. You just walk into the holy place, but this now has this entryway, which stretches the whole width of the opening of the temple. And now we're introduced to some more features that are new. We have windows. It says he made for the house windows with recessed frames. So you get light, which the tabernacle didn't have. The light was entirely from the menorah, but now we have windows in the temple. And we're told that on at least three sides of the house, you had, it's kind of hard to translate it. Here in the ESV, it's translated as a structure. So outside of the walls of the temple, on the north, south, and west sides, so the temple faced east, but on the three sides, you had the structure that was joined to the temple, and as we'll see in a minute, it had all kinds of rooms, and it was three different floors, and each of these rooms presumably then were used for all the various items that were part of the temple services. You know, so you got grain, you've got wine, you've got oil, you've got vestments, you've got all the paraphernalia that you're going to need for the temple is going to be kept in these chambers, these side chambers. And that's what's described in verses 5 and 6, basically. Verse 6 talks about the three different stories that are there. So we got the vestibule, we've got the temple proper, then we got on along the sides of it, and kind of, you can look up, there's, of course, artistic recreations of this online that you can check out. But along the side, you have this three-storied structure where, you know, basically you have storage closets for everything that you might need. Then verse 7, so that's the description of the outside. We're also told that when the house was built, it was with stone prepared at the quarry, so not at the location of the temple, but at the quarry, so that neither hammer nor axe nor any iron tool was heard in the house while it was being built. Now, that seems strange to you, and it is kind of strange because, of course, today that's the way that, I mean, I'm sure some things are hauled in, ready, prepared, but a lot of stuff is prepared right on site, but not here. And the reason seems to be based upon a couple of passages from the Torah. So if you go back to Exodus 20, 25, and then to Deuteronomy 27, 5 through 8, there's two descriptions of how altars were made. So Exodus 20, 25 says, if you make me, this is God talking, if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones, for if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. And then in Deuteronomy 27, 5 through 8, we're told about an altar that no iron tool was supposed to be wielded upon. So evidently, based upon that Torah legislation, they kind of applied that to the construction, not just of the altar, but the entire temple. So that everything was done offsite and then brought in. And I have to add this because this is one of my favorite explanations for why God did not want any iron tool being used. This is from the Jewish book called the Mishnah, which is a collection of traditions and laws compiled around 200 AD. And this is their explanation. This is not given in the Bible, but I've always kind of liked it. As a description of why iron was not to be used when the altar was built. So the Mishnah says, iron was created to shorten man's days, while the altar was created to lengthen man's days. What shortens may not rightly be lifted up against what lengthens. So I kind of thought it was cool. You know, you think of iron weapons, those shorten men's lives, but the altar is supposed to lengthen life by giving forgiveness and atonement, all those wonderful things. So pretty good Jewish explanation for why that was the case. Okay, what else? Well, verse 8 says the entrance to those parts on the outside was on the south side. And then verse 9 says Solomon built the house and finished it, made the ceiling beams and planks of cedar, and then he describes how the structure was built on the outside of it. Now, so far, all we've really heard described is what's happening on the exterior. So we had the basic framework. We have what's happening on the outside. We're going to get to the inside, which is some of the more interesting stuff, in just a minute. Before we do, though, we have verses 11 through 13, which is kind of interrupting the flow of the description of the temple with a word from God. And this word from God is pretty significant. So this is 11 through 13. The word of the Lord came to Solomon, and here's what he said. Concerning this house that you are building, if you will walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, so if you do all that, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David your father, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. Now, I don't need to tell you that if there's an if-then statement, then the if part of this about, you know, keeping statutes and obeying rules and all of that, if you do that, then I will do this, is setting, when you put that in front of a sinner, you're setting up a scenario where there's a massive chance of failure.
Yeah, well, I think the thing that's really interesting about this is that God says, concerning this house that you are building, and then says nothing about the house that he is building. Because what I think what God is saying is, thanks for the house. That's cool.
Right. Yeah, it's really cool.
But if you think that because you built me a house, that means that you're good, that you are mistaken. And so
yeah.
It seems that what he's saying is concerning this house that, and this goes back to statements that God makes all the time, that, look, what I really desire is for you to listen to me. What I really desire is for you to not have other gods. I desire that way more than I desire a house.
Yeah.
And it seems that he's letting Solomon know that the house is great, but it's not what I'm really after.
Yeah, it's kind of the minor point. The major point is, listen, I do want to dwell among you. I do want to like have a house that's right there with you. But the reason I want to be there is because you're my people and I'm your God. But here's the problem. If you go flirting with or religiously sleeping with other gods, well, then all this is going to be for naught.
Yeah, this house doesn't really mean anything if there's a house to another god next door.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's why, just guessing here, but I think that's why it's inserted here. Because you kind of get the excitement built up. Here's what the temple was like, and it was really cool, and it was this big, and we had all this stuff. And there's sort of a divine interruption. God's like, well, okay, hold on a minute. That's well and good, but let me tell you what really matters to me. here's what really matters to me. Now, this language of walking in statutes and obeying rules and keeping commandments and all of that, that's Deuteronomy type of language. And another part of Deuteronomy type language is the ongoing threat in the curses in Deuteronomy that should the people of Israel go whoring after other gods, then God will azav them. Now, azav in Hebrew is to forsake or abandon or go away from. So when we read here in 1 Kings that God will, if they do this, then he will not forsake his people. Of course, the flip side of this is that if they do all of these wicked things, then he will forsake them. And that's precisely, of course, what happens. God does forsake or abandon or leave the temple in Ezekiel's day and Jeremiah's day because they did precisely that. They polluted the temple. They built houses for other gods. They actually offered sacrifices to other gods in the very temple. A lot of very anti-God things were happening there. And so he did forsake them or leave them. This, by the way, this verb to azav or to forsake or to leave is the verb used in Psalm 22, verse 1. My God, why have you azav me? Now, we know that from what Jesus says in Aramaic on the cross, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, but in Hebrew it would be azavtani, to azav, why have you forsaken me? Which is a perfect tie-in here because the reason that Jesus was forsaken was because we didn't walk in his statutes, we didn't obey his rules, we didn't keep his commandments, so on and so forth. So when Christ, as the sacrifice on the cross, is abandoned, it's precisely because of all these things that's talked about here in 1 Kings chapter 6.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus saying, "Why have you forsaken me?" is the reason that God can say, "I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people." And this is talking about in an ultimate sense, of course. Like, ultimately, he will not forsake you. Now, God will, you know, let them be hauled off into captivity, and he will vacate the temple at times, but ultimately that he will not forsake his people. And of course, I mean, he's talking to Solomon here. Hey, walk in my statutes, obey my rules, keep my commandments. Of course, Solomon is not going to do this.
No, in fact, he will.
Like notoriously not do this.
Yes, I guess he will just like break a few minor parts of the law. He's going to completely demolish the first commandment.
Yeah, I mean, if the having no other gods is the thing that really matters to God, which of course it is, and we've talked about this a lot. I mean, if you want to know the hierarchy of the commandments, like, not having other gods is the commandment, and that's the one. Like, there's no one better at breaking this commandment than Solomon.
Yeah, he, in his unwise sort of approach to this, is going to construct temples to other gods throughout Jerusalem. I mean, I guess we shouldn't rank how bad other gods are, but there are some gods out there which, if you are going to rank false gods, are much worse than others. Moloch, for instance. I mean, there are gods to whom children are sacrificed.
Yeah, all false gods are idolatry, but some false gods have horizontal consequences of worshiping them that are far greater than others.
Yeah, and Solomon didn't just build temples or altars for the, you know, the less horizontally worse gods, but for the very worst of the worst.
Yeah.
So after that insertion of verses 11 through 13, we're going to pick it up with verse 14. And this is, if you listen to the podcast and while you're actually following along the biblical text, this is a case of what's referred to by scholars as resumptive repetition. And by that, it simply means that, and this is a lot of different places in the scriptures, a line will be repeated from the context before the interruption to kind of continue the flow of thought. So at the beginning of verse 9, we see, "So he built the house and finished it." And now verse 14 is going to say, "So Solomon built the house and finished it." In other words, it's kind of like, now back to what I was saying, or to pick up where I left off before I inserted this divine speech, let me go on and describe some other things. And what he goes on to describe in verses 14 and following is what was going on inside the house. So we're told that all this cedar that you mentioned at the beginning of the episode that he got from Hiram up in the city of Tyre that was floated down and then hauled across to Jerusalem, all that cedar was put to good use. All the walls on the inside of the house were made from cedar, from the floor to the ceiling. It was covered with this. Also, another kind of wood that's mentioned there is cypress, sometimes translated as fir or juniper. This is one of these cases where we don't know exactly to what exactly the Hebrew word refers, but anyway, cypress or juniper wood. And then we're told that verse 16, he built 20 cubits at the rear of the house with boards of cedar from the floor to the wall. And this is the inner sanctum, or the most holy place. So it is 30 by 30. It's a cube, the Holy of Holies is. And a really cool thing about that is if you go forward to Revelation, I believe it's Revelation 21:16. The city of Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem that comes down from heaven, we're given the measurements of that, and we're told that its length and its width and its height are equal. In other words, the new Jerusalem that comes down from heaven is cube-shaped, which is exactly what the Holy of Holies is. So the scholars like G.K. Beale, who will compare the temple with the church, often point out that in the new Jerusalem, the Holy of Holies is everything. The New Jerusalem is the Holy of Holies. Everything there is the Holy of Holies. And that's why all the people who are there have the name of God on their foreheads, because the high priest had the name of God on his forehead. So everybody who's there in the New Jerusalem, in the new creation, is like a high priest.
Yeah,
and the whole city is a holy of holies.
Yeah, I mean, this goes to some of the stuff that we've talked about with holiness being an issue of proximity, and in the new heavens and new earth, everything is holy because everything is in direct proximity to God.
Yeah, yeah. The Lamb, God and the Lamb are its temple.
That's right.
And that's where they are. So you're right there in the Holy of Holies, in the New Jerusalem, in the resurrection, with the name of God on your forehead. Everybody has the rank of a high priest.
Yeah.
That's a pretty awesome way to think about what the resurrection means.
And it's not some little tiny room. It's everything. Everything in the new creation exists within this holiness.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's no, in the Old Testament, if you're a long-time listener to the podcast, you know this, there's gradations of holiness, there's degrees of holiness, spheres of holiness, however you want to describe it. And you don't have that in the new creation. You don't have that in the heavenly Jerusalem that comes down. It's everything is most holy because that's where God, everything is in his direct presence. So there's no longer less holy and more holy. There's just holy because the glory of God fills the entire new creation.
Which is how holiness actually works in God. The way that God sees holiness, God doesn't see holiness as, well, there's the whole, that's holy, and then this is most holy. In God's mind, things are either holy or they're not.
Yeah, yeah. They're either of him or not of him.
That's correct.
All right, so that's the Holy of Holies. We're then given more descriptions about the nave, which is the holy place, how big it was. And then in verse 18, we're introduced to something we're going to hear much more about, and that is that the cedar inside the house had carved into it gourds and open flowers. We're going to see much more of this as we work our way through the various parts of the temple. But and I will talk about it more when we get there. I'll just mention now that when we hear language of gourds and open flowers and other kinds of parts of creation, keep in mind that the temple is designed to look like a garden, because the Garden of Eden was the first temple, and so now first the tabernacle, now the temple, are these ongoing Eden places in this world. And that's why when you walked into the tabernacle or temple, it did look like a garden paradise. It was supposed to look that way because the Garden of Eden was the temple. Now these are the places of the ongoing Eden for the Israelites. So you have gourds, open flowers. The inner sanctuary is where they put the Ark of the Covenant, of course, in the Holy of Holies. We're given its dimension again. We're told that it was overlaid with pure gold. That, by the way, is why the streets are gold in the New Jerusalem, as it's described in Revelation, because, of course, again, this is the Holy of Holies. And so in this inner sanctum, everything had to be of gold. And so you have streets of gold in the New Jerusalem. Then we're told that this is a new feature, and I'm not sure exactly how this worked, but verse 21 says that he drew chains of gold across in front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid that with gold. So I suppose there's some chains that are there. I'm not sure what purpose those served, but that's something new as well. And then we're told that once again that he overlaid the whole house with gold until all the house was finished. And then mention is made also of the altar of incense that is overlaid with gold, that's directly outside the Holy of Holies. Now, what's in the Holy of Holies? That's what verses 23 and following are going to describe to us. And quite a bit of time is spent, let's see, 23 through 28. Those verses are all about two of the most startling images that we have in the Holy of Holies, or in the temple itself, and that is the two cherubim. So two cherubim made of olive wood, each one, the dimensions just blow me away every time I read this, 15 feet high. That's a big cherub.
No, you're not going to miss that when you walk in.
You're definitely not going to miss that. So, we're told the length of their wings and that their wings touched, and it spends quite a bit of time describing how these and repeating how big these cherubim are. So we definitely get the idea of what we're looking at here. Now, cherubim are pretty fascinating creatures for lots of different reasons. We meet them first in the garden. You know, after Adam and Eve are kicked out in Genesis 3, we're told that God stationed two cherubim in Hebrew, or cherubim as we say it, there at the entrance to the Garden of Eden so that they would block the entrance for Adam and Eve. This is a pretty typical, not only the Bible, but in the ancient Near East, to have holy places that are guarded by these kinds of creatures. In other parts of the Old Testament, the cherubim are described as having the body of a lion and the wings of a bird and the face of a human. Now, if you're familiar with the Egyptian Sphinx, that's precisely what you're looking at. So the biblical description of the cherubim and the Egyptian Sphinx, I mean, at least in most of the descriptions of the biblical cherubim, there are some different kinds of descriptions in Ezekiel, but most of the time they're described, actually, just you kind of picture a Sphinx in your head. And the Sphinx, by the way, were guardians to the sacred places of the Egyptians. So this is a widespread phenomenon in the ancient world to have these kind of composite creatures where they look a little bit human and a little bit like a bird, a little bit like some kind of wild beast, like a lion. That was very common in the ancient world to have them as, they might have multiple functions, but one of the functions was kind of this idea they were guardians of these sacred spaces. And then they also functioned, the cherubim did, as the throne of God. So you can, their wings are spread toward each other. They're facing each other. The wings are spread toward each other. And God's sitting, as it were, on them. So they are his throne. And then his footstool is beneath him. It's the Ark of the Covenant. So, of course, there is no image of God there, but that's kind of the way you picture it. You got these massive beasts, 15 feet high. Their wings are stretched out, touching each other. God, invisibly, is seated on top of, enthroned upon them. And then his footstool is the Ark of the Covenant. Now, Ezekiel, when he sees the throne chariot, it's often described, the Merkavah in Hebrew, when he sees that, he sees it carried by cherubim. So the cherubim really are, they're the bearers of the throne of God. Now, in the temple, they're stationary, of course, but when Ezekiel sees them, he sees them moving around, so they're like wheels within wheels, and so the cherubim are this movable chariot kind of altar or chariot kind of throne that God sits upon. So cherubim are pretty fascinating creatures, actually, when you look at all the ways they're depicted biblically and then all the ways they're also kind of paralleled in the whole iconography of the ancient Near East. Pretty fascinating creatures.
I feel like that's good, because when most people read this, I think that they think of like Precious Moments cherubs or something. Yeah. And this is a very different kind of thing going on here.
Yeah. Oh, look at those cute little cherubs in the temple.
Little chubby baby angels, and that's not exactly it.
No, I guarantee you, if we would have seen one of these, we definitely would have need to have been told, do not fear, because we would have been scared to death. I mean, these are the kind of creatures that make you think, I'm about to die.
Yeah.
So they are not intended to be Precious Moments, cute, cuddly cherubs. They are crazy looking composite warrior animal angels, I guess, is one way we could describe them. And they're right there in the Holy of Holies. And then the rest of the description continues with verse 28, with we have engraved figures of cherubim and palm trees and open flowers throughout the house. And then we have doors in this temple, doors into the inner sanctuary, and then doors on the outside as well. And those are described in verses 31 through 35. So
it's weird that there's these carvings of these cherubim all over the place too.
Yeah. All over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, and as we'll see when we get to kind of some of the outside furnishings, like the Bronze Sea and some other parts of it, there's also images of the cherubim outside as well. So I think the overall visual impact is supposed to be this, that when you're in the presence of God, you're also in the presence of his heavenly host. just visually, that's supposed to be the impression given. It's kind of like, you know, when you if you've ever been inside a Greek Orthodox church, of course there's icons everywhere. And the reason there are icons everywhere, it's supposed to visually communicate to you that you're not just in a place on earth, but you're also in the presence of Christ and the heavenly host. Well, that's kind of what's going on here at the temple too. You're in the garden paradise. So you're still on earth for sure. But when you enter into the area around the temple, you're in a different kind of earthly place, because here God has actually come down. He's dwelling there. He's got his angels. His heavenly hosts are there. And it's not pretend. It's not make-believe. But it really is happening. You are stepping into a celestial part of the earth, if you will. You're stepping onto holy ground, because that's where God has promised to be. And then the chapter wraps up by telling us it's we're really not done with it yet. We're going to hear more about the temple in chapter 7, but chapter 6 wraps up by saying, in the fourth year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv. And in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all its parts and according to all its specifications. So he was 6 years, technically 6 years and 7 years and 6 months in building it. So quite an undertaking. So it took quite a while to get there. And like I said, he's not, even though it says he's finished and it makes it sound like we're done with the temple, he's going to pick it back up in verse 13 of chapter 7. We're going to have a little break in between to hear about some other building projects of Solomon. But that anyway gives you a pretty good perspective on the some of the structure anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you got to get into the furnishings later on.
Yeah, got to hear more about those in just a minute. Before we do, though, we're told that Solomon was quite the builder, because he wasn't just building a temple for God, a house for Yahweh, but also was building his own house. So the first 12 verses of chapter 7 are going to tell us about some of these places. Now, if you thought the temple was complex, well, you ain't seen nothing yet, because Solomon's house and all his other houses, it's kind of like this whole complex, are bigger,
of course,
and more intricate, and there's more of them. This is kind of low-hanging fruit for preachers, but this is always used by commentators as well to point out that if you were impressed by Solomon's building of a house for Yahweh, then you'll really be impressed by the house he built for himself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, chapter 6 ends with, so this thing took about 11 years. And then chapter 7 starts with, and Solomon was building his own house 13 years.
And then, yeah.
You wonder, is he like gathering at the same time? Like, hey, make sure you send enough wood for both these things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like I built a shack for God, and I'm going to build this palace for myself. It's kind of the feeling that you get. So, yeah, verse 1 starts out by saying Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished his entire house. But it wasn't just a single structure. And I wish we knew more about the exact usage of some of these. So verse 2 says he built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Now, if you name a house the forest of Lebanon, you know there's a lot of cedar in that house.
Yeah, you cut down a whole forest and built a house out of it.
That's impressive. Yeah, that's a lot of cedar. The house of the forest of Lebanon, one of the strangest named buildings in the Old Testament. And I wish we knew more about it, what it was used for. It was big, so it was about 150 feet long and pretty wide and pretty high, and they were given some more details about pillars inside it, window frames, and whatnot. I didn't look into this very deeply, but I do know in a few more chapters we're going to be told about some weaponry that were stored in the house of the forest of Lebanon. So maybe it was kind of like an armory, possibly used as a treasury too. Who knows? But we are at least told about some weaponry that were stored there. But a pretty impressive structure. And then we hear about the Hall of Pillars, which is described in verse 6. Nothing else said about that, just given its dimensions. So we have the house of the Forest of Lebanon. And then we have the Hall of Pillars. And number seven describes another one, the Hall Throne where he was to pronounce judgment, which is also called the Hall of Judgment. Well, that one is kind of self-explanatory. This is evidently where Solomon would hear cases that were brought to him, like the one we talked about earlier with the two mothers, one of whose son was dead and one whose son was alive. Presumably, this was like the courtroom, I guess. And then verse 8, so we're not done. We have House of the Forest of Lebanon, House Hall of Pillars, the Hall of Judgment. And now we also have Solomon's house, his own house where he was to dwell. And then Solomon also made a house for his wife, one of his wives, Pharaoh's daughter. And then we're given various details about that. There were costly stones and huge stones, given their measurements and how they were all laid out there, so that we can get this overall impression of the extent to which Solomon went in order to make all these various complex of buildings. And you can see why, if there's that many, it took him 13 years to finish everything.
It is interesting that he builds a separate house for his wife, the daughter of Pharaoh. Now, we know that Solomon's going to end up with a lot of wives, and he's not going to build a house for each of them, because that would be, he never stopped building if he was doing that. But it is interesting for this, you have a particular house built for this particular wife, which is sort of the first foreign wife that he takes. And you have to wonder if this is, you know, back in when Caesar, you know, married Cleopatra, he didn't really marry her, and he just brought her back to Rome with him, and then he had her like stay in a different place, so that people could that way he could be like, well, you know, it was just, you know, it's an alliance kind of thing, but we're not like living together.
Political marriage.
We're not living together. You know, it's not. I wouldn't. You know, bring this foreign woman into my house and stuff. I'm just trying to look out for you. You have to wonder if that's a little bit of what's going on here. Like, why they got a separate house? Either they don't get along at all, and Solomon's like, I'll just build your own house to keep you away from me, or it's something like that. This is just to sort of keep up appearances.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, it's a great parallel too with what happened in Rome. It would probably pacify some people who might be concerned, like, what the heck, Solomon? Why are you marrying a princess from the very land that once enslaved us?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a good look. So, it does kind of make sense. He could always say, oh, well, you know, it's not like we're actually, you know, living as husband and wife. It's a political arrangement. So she's got her own house. We're not sleeping in the same bed or anything like that.
Yeah. Don't worry. No children coming from this. You know, your next king's not going to be, you know, part Egyptian. Don't worry about it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But when he starts marrying other foreign wives and then starts building temples for these wives, you can tell the road that he's already going down by marrying the Egyptian princess. And we will go down that road with him pretty quickly, because things begin to fall apart. After we get past the building of the temple, things will begin to fall apart pretty quickly. But we got to get the temple built. We'll talk more next time about the particular furnishings that are inside it. And then we have that long prayer of dedication for the temple as well. So we'll get into more of that in the upcoming episodes.
All right, man. Well, I will see you then.
See you then.